Okay, you warmly welcome to our panel about playing politics, political aspects in computer games. My name is Peggy Sulop. I want to introduce now the panelists. First, I begin with Andreas Lange, who is director of the Computerspielemuseum Berlin. And then I go on with Michael Liebe, who studied political science and media studies and made his PhD about rules in computer games. And he's also co-founder of the Digital Game Research Center at University of Potsdam. Then I want to introduce Susanne Eichner. She studied cultural studies and media studies at the University College of Suffolk and is working now at the HFF in Potsdam, the Hochschule für Film und Fernsehen in Potsdam. And she made a dissertation for agency in computer games, film and television. And then here is Niklas Schrape. He made a very interesting article about rhetoric in Peacemaker. And also it's your dissertation about what was it, rhetoric in computer games in general. Okay, we're going to speak about that exactly. And then we have Mark Butler, who's also a member of the Digital Game Research Center at University of Potsdam. You are? And you're a cultural scientist and futurologist, right? Yes. Right. So I give, and my name is Peggy Sulp, like I said, and I'm also a colleague of Andreas Lange at the Computerspielemuseum. I'm also co-founder of ARI, the Artistic Research Encounters, together with Lily Fürstenhoff, who is also a doctorandin at the Humboldt University.
Yes, thank you. I'm very glad to welcome you all at this panel. Playing politics, the aspects of politics in computer games. So we thought about this issue, and in the very beginning, I just thought maybe it's all actually exaggerated, and it's all playing in game, and what does the player actually feel? Does he feel this political influence, or it's just our fantasy? And then I had a look at the history, and it really gets into the 17th century, and actually it began with this, how they say, Brettspiel, where actually the wars have been simulated, and then it developed and developed, and it was this General Clausewitz. He used actually the Brettspiel, the playing of the battles, and then actually he used that for his actual battles as a military strategy. And I have been thinking how the game actually developed and if there is any comparison between the strategic games and computer games. And I'm very glad that the director of the Computerspielemuseum Berlin is here with us. Maybe you could actually tell about the history of computer games, how they developed, and is there any political influence in that, and if there is a difference between these games, actual games, and computer games, what is the difference?
In my opinion, basically, and in principle, computer games are games as traditional games. But there is a difference. The difference is that computer games are more capable to tell concrete stories, to handle concrete characters. In traditional games, for example, Czech or Mensch ärger dich nicht, you are also using game characters, but they are looking more like symbols. And so because of the computers, computer games are able somehow to merge the other mediums like film especially with the traditional games. And the outcome is slightly different because the surface is looking different. But if you are looking through the surface, if you are looking behind the concrete characters, and if you're looking behind the concrete stories which are told in computer games, you see general game patterns. Usually it's somehow a matter of resources. You only have limited resources, and you must invest the resources in the most effective way. And this is a very general, common kind of gameplay. And in this layer, computer games are pretty much similar with traditional games. And if you ask me for the development, yes, of course, there is. You can see examples and attempts all over the history of computer games, in which computer games intensely should handle and focus on political situations. One of the first of these games is Balance of Power from the game designer veteran Chris Crawford, and this was done, I think, in 1990, something like this. It's more or less a simulation game which handles or which deals with the Cold War situation, and this is an early example of an attempt to make a computer game with an expressively political setting.
I just want to say this aspect of simulation or reality, to what extent is it in the computer games? And I also wanted to add the civilization game. I mean, they also could be, it's a battle between the states, then one state could just conquer the other. And how does it work, the political influence, in the way you play them? And if there are any more examples of such games, just...
Hi. Just, you know, to get into discussion mode, I wanted to go to your first question and then go to the second question. The first one, I would disagree on one point, Andreas. I think, on the one hand, you're right, there are very many continuities between pre-digital games and digital games, but I think the digital media really brings something new to the fore, just because you have the computer implementing rules in a very, you know, hard-coded way. They're not as easy to change for the players as with traditional games. First point. Second point, you can implement much more complex rules in the computers, so that opens up completely new game types that weren't there before. Then you have single-player mode, which you really didn't have before except for solitaire. I mean, you had some examples, but not as many single players as now. And now you have massively multiplayer. So there is some change in there. Second question about the development of games, one can say that gaming technology as a whole has a political dimension because it comes out of military technology. The development of computers was in the military context, and they were only secondarily used to play games on. And things like, you know, adventure games were directly derived from the development of the ARPANET, which became the Internet, which was a military project to begin with. So there are tons of examples to go into on that. When you ask for examples of concrete games that have political dimensions, one could say any game that has a reference to the real world, that's not something like abstract like Tetris, has a political dimension because it's always ideological. It's always implementing a certain version of the world according to the rule system and not another one. So you're never going to have a game that's not ideological. That's it.
All right, just to react to that. I think the main point is you asked how a game can be a simulation, basically. And in my opinion, I would agree that every game basically has the potential to be understood as a simulation. That is to say that it depends totally on the player if he wants to see it as a simulation or he does not. But if the game cues the understanding of the player in such a way that it makes references to our concept of the reality or something, then it can be understood as such. And this is basically what you can analyze in a game to see how it guides this understanding. And so if you think about civilization, the example you mentioned, you obviously it represents in some way the world history, but in a very fragmented and inconsistent way, actually, because obviously you play the whole history anew and within the rules of the game. The rules of the game are not really the rules of reality. But still, it makes something quite interesting. That is to say that you have these nations, you have the world leaders, and you know these characters, even if it doesn't make any sense that Alexander the Great lives for 3,000 years or something. But still, you get the concept, right? It has something to do with history and something to do with reality. And it even has some... it backs its own interpretation of history a little bit up, because if it has this kind of lexicon, this encyclopedia, behind the game. So, you know, right, the designers, they really made some research, they know something about history. So we think, right, maybe the reality I'm playing is really connected to the reality of history, and in such a way that the rules of the game simulate what history is about. But this obviously is not true. But still, it's part of the fun. So you get, if you play it, you have a little bit like kind of illusion. You have this idea of, yes, I'm really playing history. And it's a lot of fun, actually, to say, right, I'm playing, I don't know, the Egypt, and I just destroyed the United States of America or something like that. So that's obviously part of the fun. And so, but to conclude one second, is... you mentioned this, I think it's called Kriegsspiel, you know, this game the Prussian military used for training, basically. Here you have an interesting fact, because this game is a simulation, but it's really understood in extreme way as simulation, because I'm not sure if the people really had fun playing it, because they played it for a training purpose. And you have this exact same situation you have with these games or non-games, with this military simulations of the U.S. Army. Because many, many ego shooters especially use elements of these simulations, technical elements like, you know, the engine behind it and so on. But these simulations are understood not as games, I would argue, but as something else. And to you really push this discussion a little bit further, think about Breivik, this killer of Oslo. He used, I think, Call of Duty for training purpose. I'm not sure if he had fun. I think it was really a training tool. So he made it to something else, actually. And you can always do that with games.
Hi, I just wanted to correct something. I'm not really see myself as the academic anymore. I work at Medium Board since 2 years now, and I'm project leader of the Deutsche Gamestag, which is a more an industry-driven event, which just stopped last week in Berlin. So I actually am hoping to bring in more a bit the industry perspective, perhaps the knowledge from that point of view. Civilization is one of the games which brought me into this whole mess with liking computer games. When I was a kid, I rather played Civilization than going to school. And actually, for me, it was the first encounter of like the Zulu or the Incas or stuff like that. I mean, which 10-year-old kid knows what the Zulu are? Or who here knows what a Zulu is? Actually, who knows Civilization, the game? Around half of it. Perhaps you can just throw in some images on the screen. That would be... perfect. Like if you just check Moby Games, for example, and Hack and Civilization, so that people get an image of what it is. And Civilization is, because it's super interesting, this game. It's the first game was 1992, and the last game was 2009, I think, the last release of Civilization 5. And then in between there were, in total it was like 6 or 7 iterations of the game, and in between there was also Call to Power Civilization by another developer, but with the same game mechanics. So why is Civilization interesting? Because it started to 1992 and it is now in the sphere of digital games for almost 20 years, and it evolved. Every step of the game reflected a different type of common ideology. So 1992 was just after the Cold World War, American dominance. It started with a little settler, the American dream. You start with your wagon. If you see the first image of Civilization, it's a typical American settler wagon. And then from there on, you conquer the empty space and you encounter some barbarians, you kill them, you encounter some, Germans, you kill them, you encounter some French, you kill them, etc. pp. And that's the only gameplay. Yes, you conquer, you expand and conquer. And it was the main winning condition except for space ship building. Conquering the moon was the next step. So either you destroy everybody else on the planet or you conquer the moon to expand your territory. But now, Civilization 5, you win either through political diplomacy or through religious dominance or through economic dominance or scientific dominance or still warfare dominance. And that is one of the best examples, I guess, to show how common ideology of a culture where such a game is created in can or is found in such artifacts as computer games. And but I'll stop here and let somebody else add.
I just want to mention something, add something to that. I mean, if you... Civilization is obviously like a game which has politics as a obvious thematic. So, but I have totally to agree with Mark that like you can't have any representational media without being ideological. So, and the example of Civilization, if you look at films, the best example is the genre of the Western. There you have thematized certain ideologies which are placed into a certain time period, so you can follow the argument of Michael by looking at the Western genre in film as well. And so, I mean, for me it's really hard to imagine any computer game which has no ideological or political impact.
Please.
I just wanted to add some very little thing, that is that, as you mentioned, Civilization, this game, which is a very, very good example, it evolved. And you really can, actually, you can trace back the political influences, because when the third game came out, I think, they had this idea of cultural spheres. And basically, it was around 2000 or something. And at this time, this whole book by Samuel Huntington, Clash of Civilizations, that's right, was very, very popular and very much in the media. And they included this political concept in the game. And when the fourth game came out, it included the concept of religion. So you had suddenly a different religion. So and this was about, I don't know, 2004 maybe. So the whole idea after 9/11 that religion is basically back in play in world politics was very in vogue. So we can really trace back the influences, and that's quite interesting.
Civilization is a fascinating example, and thank you for going through the development of it, because I mean, even with all these different winning conditions, whether it's war or religion or politics, it all boils down to the same game mechanic. You win by territorial domination, you know, and even with the cultural spheres, it's all about, you know, building these world wonders that then expand your sphere and sort of, you know, take over the life world. You know, it's sort of this blood and Boden, as you'd say in German, mentality. You know, that there's a very strategic paradigm going on there that it can be fleshed out in different ways, but it's always the same thing, basically. And then you asked for other examples, and it is interesting to move on. I mean, even games where one doesn't suspect ideology, like I don't know, another strategy game would be SimCity. I don't know which iteration, but there was one, you know, where there was a bias that, you know, if you, it's either if you lower taxes, you know, you're more successful, or if you invest more in police precincts, whatever the rule is, there's always going to be a rule and there's always going to be some cultural bias in there. Moving on to different genres, I personally was fascinated by Grand Theft Auto 4, which one could call a playful simulation of, you know, capitalism in the 21st century, you know, just because it's a satire and it's a parody, not only in the radio spots and the TV spots, but in the gameplay in and of itself. You know, it's all about becoming this, you know, kingpin and hoarding all this money. And at the end, you have this tragic ending where you lose everything and the figure is broken. So that's a political commentary on the state of the USA in present day time, which I think is, you know, a very successful political critique, you know, using all the methods of the medium. And someone could go on. I mean, there are some decidedly political games out there that say I'm political, like, for example, a Force More Powerful or People Power, which are developed as serious games. They're supposed to teach people social organizing skills, and where it's not about conquering, you know, some other country. It's about, you know, organizing students to sort of overthrow a corrupt dictatorial government or something. And there are fascinating examples out there that we could go into on detail, but I don't want to take all the time here.
Peggy, do you have a question or I just... Yeah, that's a whole lot of games, actually. What I was interested to know, so how does it actually go on? Which factors influence the development strategy of the games? So it is the sales. How does it develop? So you said, is it really the sales, the industry, that the people buy more if there is more this impact of territorial conquering? What are the basic factors that stand behind this development of the games in this way and not the other way?
So in my opinion, and you can correct me, is it so the most important is that a game makes fun for the player. And then there's a second important aspect that you can sell it. So you have somehow to set up a marketing strategy. And in that respect, if you use certain story setting, that could help for the marketing strategy. And so I think these are the most important points. Then, of course, there's another field there's another kind of developers. So Mark just mentioned them briefly. These are developers who want to who has a message somehow, and this is not the mainstream developer. This is, you can call them independent developers or so. And also for these kind of games, it is important that they make fun to play. And if they are failing in this respect, they usually will not used, and they will not played frequently by players. And so for me, the most important question, or one of the most important questions today is, or tonight is, what happens with politics and with political settings if they become part of gameplay? I think this is the transfer which is really exciting to look at it more closely.
In some point, I disagree with you, because, I mean, it's a very idealized view of how do computer games develop, because behind the computer games, you have a huge computer game industry, and then the major point is not always, unfortunately, that the game is fun, but that the game sells in the first place. And, I mean, no, it's not, well, if the game is fun or if the game sells, it's not the same, because the game sells maybe because it's a franchise text, or because you have like
a powerful distributor behind it. So I think the power of the gamer to influence how the games will develop, sure, is there, because in the end, a game will only resell and resell again if it's really good and if it's fun to play. Yeah, but the industry shows something else. I mean, you have all these spin-offs of films which are sometimes not fun at all to play.
Yes, it's true. You have some marketing power and then it sells easier. But still, if it's not fun, it won't sell more. You will have a first rush in the first 2 weeks. It will sell. Okay, they will get in the back in their money. But to be a real hit, like GTA, for example, or Civilization, it has to be fun in the long term for a lot of people. And your question was actually quite good, because it refers to some myth out there that during wartime, war games sell bigger, and that actually almost all games are war games or have war topics. But if you check on the sales of the games in a whole, first-person shooters are 3% of the whole market share. And check out what you all are playing on your smartphones. Angry Birds. Who knows Angry Birds? Less than Civilization, I don't believe you. Who knows Angry Birds? Still not more. Okay. Strange. But in Angry Birds, you play little birds. You shoot birds at mean Nazis disguised as pigs. But nobody would put it in the war context or a brutal topic or whatever. It's a cute little game with happy music, and it's easy to control, and it's like everybody in the whole world plays it. You even get it in Middle Africa, and people play it there, in which for Civilization you cannot say. So this is a myth with the war as a main topic on computer games, and it's a myth that during war times, war games sell bigger, because you always had war games as a topic. It's the most sensible topic, because in games you fight out a conflict. And a war is a very easy to understand type of conflict. And everybody knows what war is. It's in our nature, and you know you have to win if you're attacked.
It really needs fixed values, because it's a calculator. So if you play with friends in an informal kind of way, like, you know, kids playing, I don't know, Cowboys and Indians, they don't have this kind of very fixed rules, but computers always need them. That doesn't mean that the player experience can be put in numbers, but it does mean that everything which you try to simulate in a game has to be brought down into numbers and has to become quantifiable and to be calculatable. I don't know if this is the right word, but anyway. And I think this is quite fascinating, because this is something we experience in our world today, not only in games, but also, for example, in economy. Like, everything becomes quantifiable. You want to calculate everything, and we try to have simulation models about reality, like, for example, about what happens to world economy, and then suddenly some crisis came, and they discovered, wait a minute, our models are wrong. And maybe one of the first mistakes was to make everything quantifiable, basically. And I think this is the breath thing. Right.
Because I think this is also what is your argumentation as well, and which we touched on before, that we always, in computer games, we have the interesting thing that we have the underlying game rules, and they can be interpreted as being political, because you have yes-no decisions in computer games, or definite decisions and not-so-soft decisions. And the other thing is the representational layer of computer games, which can be full of meaning as well. So I think that's the interesting thing about games, computer digital games.
So there are two ways to look on politics and games. What you mean, actually, what you say, let them play computer games. It's more the relationship between politicians and people gaming. It's not exactly politics. So politics is not the politicians. So it's kind of different. And also, what I see also is, In politics also, it starts now that people don't believe anymore in game theory, in the way that that decisions are made really by rationally. And that's actually what you have to do when you're programming a game. You have to make really rational possibilities of decisions. And that's actually not how you make a good decision in politics. Politics positions in reality should be a process of dialogue where you participate as much as you can. It's what we try also here, you know, with this Occupy thing. And that's, and then starts the other way around, the gamification of politics. What you have, for example, in the liquid feedback system of what are using the pirates now. That you have the possibility that everybody can participate in a discussion. This is so in that moment, what you're saying, when you connect politics and computer games, so it might be more serious, might be a serious game. So in a way, it is serious, you know. But on the other side, playing with this liquid feedback can be really good fun also. You know, because it's the moment of participation can be something that is self-satisfying and can be a good thing about. So we just had this panel at the Computerspielmuseum about gamification and politics, and probably Andreas can explain a bit what we figured out there.
Yeah, so one conclusion was that it's not really a game to go into liquid feedback and try to set up a proposal or other things which liquid feedback is made for. It's work. So it's work on texts. It's work on arguments. It's discussions with the others. And on the surface, yes, there is a similarity because you can gain power. The others can delegate their votes to you, so you can become a powerful character in liquid feedback. But then doing it, it's not playing politics. It's tough work, which of course can be satisfying. Like every kind of work can be satisfying, but I think we shouldn't make the mistake to mix it up. I think there's a very important difference between doing politics and playing a game.
So it was the subject of gamification of society. The difference between real politics and politics in computer games, so it's becoming smaller and smaller. I just wanted to make it clear, what is the difference between the mechanisms of this political struggle, how it is in the computer games, it is visuals, it is the way you make the decision making, how is the player influenced into one ideology or the other, and how is it in real politics? Is it also maybe visual? What are the parallels and the differences? Maybe we could specify on that.
Sorry, but I have to take that. It's the consequences. It's not about how it's presented or whatever. You can make everything playful. Check in, take Foursquare. Just going to a panel can be playful. I check in, I'm major of KW now, for example, because I checked into KW 20 times, which is not true. I don't use Foursquare, but just to give you an example. And it looks nice, it's pretty, but the consequences is a difference. It doesn't matter. I'm major of Foursquare, so what? But if you're a leader of liquid democracy, you can make decisions which have real-life consequences for other people who didn't participate in that game. And that's a huge difference. So the aesthetics and structures can be very similar, but the main difference are the consequences.
And that said, and that being a traditional definition of game, I do think there are situations where you have people playing games that do have very serious consequences for other people. And I'm actually very... happy that this whole topic of gamification came up, the whole topic of game theory, because when you look at current day casino capitalism, and I mean that in literal sense of the word. I mean, Susan Strange, the political scientist, made that term up in 1986, not as an analogy, but she really meant it. People in the financial market are, not all of them, but some of them, and in increasing numbers, are in a playful mode of dealing with the world, because they are only dealing with these virtual quantities that aren't, you know, anchored in the real world economy anymore, pushing numbers back and forth on the computer screen, you know, like working with one of these strategy games. There's really, there are some very, very important questions to be asked here, and whether work and play are still as separated in the 21st century as they were in the 20th and the 19th is a question I would like to raise. There have been terms come up, like my colleague Julian Kukli came up with the term playber to talk about that kind of mix, and you have games like World of Warcraft where the players are going through the grind, and it feels sort of like work. And then you have some work settings where people say, well, it feels a little bit like play. And, you know, in the neoliberal economy, the boundaries between work time and recreation time are sort of, you know, becoming dissolved, and we're constantly on the job and we're supposed to be having a good time. And so I think we're in a completely new cultural situation due to the, among other things, the rise of, you know, information technology and communication technology, and the whole digital media in the last 30 years have really created this new situation where these old play paradigms don't fit necessarily anymore.
Sorry. Yeah, of course, it's the traditional definition, but I think it's still valuable, because if you are talking about playfulness, you can make everything playfulness. But if you want to sort of be able to talk about civilization in contrast to liquid democracy, you need to have some, or there are possible definitions that differentiate the two. And they are different. They have different purposes, they have different usage contexts, and they have different outcomes and different consequences. And if you use the commercial or artistic, whatever, artifact called game, it's something different than a playful attitude or playful tools to do real-life actions.
Yes, I think I would agree to that, because it's... but also to you, because it's right. I mean, this whole, I think because we make the whole world more ruled by algorithms, basically, you know, like the whole idea of social networks, which work quite similar to computer games sometimes, we make a little bit more open to be played in a certain way. But on the other hand, this is not new. I mean, if you just imagine a soccer player. Sorry. I mean, soccer is a game. Soccer is fun. So you play it for recreation outside of work. But now imagine someone who becomes a professional soccer player. So maybe at first it still is fun, and then this shifts more and more, and then it becomes work, and then it's not fun anymore, because it really depends on it for his money, but also it's because it's really, really just tough, hard work. And I think the same happens with computer games, basically. If you really play e-sport, for example, like this is playing computer games in competitions for money, basically, for you have winning prizes, and you can make a living out of it, especially in Korea. Then it's not the same anymore. I mean, and then it's more like you have fun in your work, but still it's work. And also, like in World of Warcraft, you have these players who basically play for other players and try to how is it called? Farming, I think. You level them up. You basically have this first world people who own characters in this in World of Warcraft, but they don't have the time, because basically they are managers or something. They don't have the time to play all the time. So they make a contract to some guy in China who plays for them and basically levels this character up. And I think for this Chinese guy, this isn't fun, because actually the game is quite boring
on that note. Julian DeBell, the guy who first sort of pointed his finger to the gold farming phenomenon, went over there and interviewed these people and saw them at work. And he was astounded. It's in the New York Times article. He says, yes, it's work. It's hard grinding work. But they play the game in their free time. And while they're at work, they're still laughing and cheering each other on and having fun. And so he really really did an in-depth ethnography of this and pointed to the fact that it's hard to discern, you know, where the work starts and where the play starts and what where it ends and all that.
Especially with the soccer game, you have to. There's another component that you have the viewers who watch the soccer game. So it's there's another component which comes up to a soccer game. But still, the context question is. I think it's a question which is, especially if you look at serious games, it's also an interesting question because if you play serious games and somebody wants to give you a message and somebody wants to point you towards something, then it's easy to switch the context from a game to something you don't enjoy, maybe. So maybe the context question is an important one.
It's also a question about if you say you simulate reality, it's a simulation game, but it's actually, also before we had this, when is it training? For reality, when it is just a game with no consequences. So where is actually the border, you know? Where is actually the border between work and game? You know, for example, if you... the concentration after computer games, they made this, this test, is not the same like before. You know, if you're playing one-hour computer games, you worked. It has nothing to do if it makes fun or not. So it's a kind of, you have to be really concentrated to win. You don't feel because it's good fun, but you're actually working. Working can make good fun. So I have the feeling all these typical words, expression doesn't mean the same in the whole thing. This is virtual world, simulation, not simulation, politics, game. This is all kind of, you know, one bubble, cloudy thing, you know, it's something that I have the feeling here. But I wanted to come back to something else what Susanne said before. It is about but if it's fun or not fun, does it make fun? And I think it's a question of whom does it make fun? Whom actually is a game targeted to? And why is echo shooting so important, even if it's just 3%, what you told me? And it's also what you told me in the talk before, that you are also with a gender question in this context. And I want to ask you if you think that actually the game industry does care anything about this kind of question, and actually thinks about I'm just saying that I think that a typical gamer meant by the gaming industry is a young man between 20 and 30, you know, and it's the game industry is following that one. So I do, for example, I think about the education things in the Computerspiele Museum, and they are realized elderly people are not thought about. Women usually are not thought about also. So I think it is also an ideological thing, actually also a political decision whom you aim your computer game to. What do you think?
I mean, that's an old question, isn't it? I don't know. I think it's like with other media as well. There are computer games made especially for girls, and then you have something like you have an industry which says, "Okay, let's exploit another big possible audience. Then we can make more money." And then they try different things, like making pink computer games, and let's see if girls play more games then as well. But that's really silly, a silly thing. But what is really important, I think, is that a video game somehow attaches to your socialized life and to your interests, and that's why ego shooters maybe, and that's a possible explanation why are there so many male players, because it's like playing with or the war strategy games, because it's playing with weapons and all that stuff, and I would never argue with nature, but socialized, girls are not as much socialized with the weapons and war gaming. So that is a typically male-pointed genre. So, and I think it's so interesting to develop different genres or different kinds of putting the playing aspect into a digital game. What you said, it's very easy to make the war thing into a game because it's so easy to make the rules and it's so easy and everybody understands it. And I think it would be so interesting to find other easy communicating playful ideas to be packed up and wrapped up in a digital game.
Yeah, could you just put www.wooga.com, W-O-O-G-A, World of Gaming. It's exactly what you're saying. It's about new target groups. Obviously, first-person shooters target young men between 18, actually, because most of them are USK 18, so you're not allowed to play them under 18, and 35 to 40. It's not really the teenage target group, actually, today at least. Wooga with W. And then and that segment is filled. You know, it's there are so many games out there every year, two or three first-person shooters coming out. It's very difficult to get success. So the industry is broadening up. Since 2006, there's the Wii console, which was mainly targeted on families. And 2006, now 7 years, 8 years ago almost. Six years ago. No, and so the industry has shifted radically since then. And Wooga, that's why I wanted to show you this. The players of this game are female and in the level average 54 years old. And how do they manage to do that? It's exactly by what Susanne says. It's not about the shooting. It's about sharing and social communication and using Facebook as a main platform where you just say, okay, I just got this and can you help me solving this level? Or hooray, I just won this cute little monster for my collection and blah, blah, stuff like that. And actually, it's the new competition for soap operas. That's the same target group. And now they're playing Wooga and not watching TV anymore.
So I'd just like to try to maybe put gaming in the context of the social movements that are happening right now, including the one that we are kind of hosted by here, the Occupy. So I think that if, you know, there's all these young people who are out of jobs and they're going on the streets and they're occupying public space and they're not doing it necessarily because it's fun. So for me, it wouldn't be too hard to imagine that they're also going home and willing to play a game that's also not necessarily super fun. So I guess basically what I'm trying to say is, do you think that that games, can we look forward to a time where games are not just embracing neoliberal principles or providing, like the few that you said are actually providing critiques of them, but are actually providing answers or sort of alternative models to how we organize society?
Well, yes, I do. I can't imagine. And there are examples out there. Again, if you're interested in a game that I haven't played it myself, but it seems to be well made, and I can imagine it's fun. But I think it's also a powerful tool in teaching people social organizing skills. I would definitely recommend you checking out People Power online, because that's actually a game that is based on, you know, sociological models of, you know, how these kind of events take place and how something like the Occupy movement, you know, takes place and teaches people how to harness this power. So there are already examples out there. And actually, this is one of the most exciting developments of the last, I don't know, correct me, Michael, I would say maybe 10 years. I mean, the whole rise of the independent game scene. I mean, in the meantime, there are game engines out there that are accessible for people who don't have gigantic budgets, and people are doing very interesting things. And that's where all the creative work is being done, also in terms of gender. I mean, basically looking at the big companies, producing a game nowadays, producing a AAA title is so expensive that the big companies stick to the formulas that work. The interesting stuff is really coming out of independent game studios. And I don't know, the hair's cringed a little bit on my back from a gender perspective. When, you know, Hey, Michael, you were saying, and it's obviously a fact that there are a lot of female players of this Wooga game. In general, female players do a lot of online games. I think they're not ready to invest as much money. They go more for the browser games. They spend more, actually. Okay, fascinating. But what I wanted to say is I know a lot of female players who also go for the ego shooters. I don't know how much of this breaks down into gender lines. And there are fascinating examples out there. Just wanted to mention Heather Kelly, who did a wonderful game based the game mechanics were inspired by the dynamics of the female orgasm, which, you know, I thought was a fascinating game experiment in and of itself. And so you have all this interesting stuff happening in the independent sphere. Right?
Yeah, but Michael, I just wondered, you might know more about that, because all the interesting films we have, yeah, we have them because they are because we have a Filmförderung. Yeah, so I think this is a political issue as well. So. I think it's very hard to make innovative independent games because there isn't such an institutionalized funding for them. So for films, especially like in France, where you have the French film, which is supported, it's a completely different area. You can be much more experimental than you can be with the games, isn't it? Like with selling games, not with browser games.
Yeah, genau. Medienboard has a content funding program for video games as well as it has for films. It's 30 million, around 29 million for films per year and 1 million for everything else, and including mobile apps and games. And yes and no. It's I don't think political activists would necessarily apply for content funding at Medienboard to make a political dramatic game. I'm not sure if that's true, but there's people, especially in Italy, like Molle Industria. Everybody should know them. They're the best example for political left-winged gamified comments on society, like the McDonald's game or Pedo Priest, where gay priests abuse little kids and stuff like that. And they're not fun, but they're very dramatic and very important to be out there, and they're not funded by a public institution. So I'm not sure if that's the cause why, or a cause and effect between political games or and not. But creativity, of course, and experimental games, we get a lot of applications of startups or little kids who just left school and are doing their company now and want to do the next big thing. We actually do get very little really innovative creative content where you say, okay, that this couldn't come out of a bigger company. But what is also interesting is all these monetizing programs where you use game mechanics to help other institutions, like social institutions. There's in Berlin, there's Chava Chava, for example. They use social media games. And these ladies who play Diamond Dash, they pay like $50 per month. So imagine buying GTA every month. And using that monetization model to not only pay Wooga and Facebook, but also pay, I don't know, some Caritas like institution. And that's a new trend, growing and growing, where you use the money of the other people and motivate them to pay more, so it's good for the company as well. And they have the feeling, okay, I help some kids in Africa or the Occupy movement or whatever, and buy a new virtual teddy bear.
I will be just coming to you, Andreas. So I had this question, maybe it's more of a proposal, that I think it's a wonderful chance for the museum actually also to introduce its policy, I mean, some educational aspect. I mean, not only to promote the war games, but to educate the visitors and the players, and just to promote other sorts of games or make more educational, like I think you do it already, the panel discussions and the workshops, but put some more impact on the other aspects of games other than the wars, and because the industry does the rest for the other games. But this educational aspect, I mean, for the museum, that would be very interesting just to support that line.
Yeah, so that's somehow how we set up our exhibition. It's a medium by its own, an exhibition. It's a real space medium, and so we did it in a playful way, and we try to show the variety of computer games and all the different important aspects they have and interfaces they have. There are still a lot of questions because it's a pretty new thing, and somehow I agree with Mark that there's something going on, and it's important that we try to understand and what's going on and somehow evaluate it by our own. How do we like it or do we like it not? I think, yes, I agree with you that there the borders between work and play are blurring. And that it's because of the digital technology, it's because of the nature of computer games, it's because of the nature of our workplaces. So, but do we like it? Do we like what happened with the gamers at Wall Street and what they did? Do we like that? And so this is, I think, something we should have an opinion about that. And to have this, to get this opinion, we must somehow have a serious look at what's going on. That's important. And another question I have, especially to you, it's on your answer you gave to the guy from the audiences. I also agree with you. Yes, we can learn a lot of things for our real life by playing, but what is special about computer games? So the reasons or the answers you gave is just true for every game. So you learn social behavior, for example. This is something what you just mentioned. It's true for every kind of game, not only for digital games. I would add, for example, what you else can learn is that you can learn to handle situations where you have lost. So don't that you don't lose your encouragement, that you just try it again. So this is also something very important you can learn, but this is not dedicated only to computer games. So do you have an answer to him which is dedicated to computer games? So
starting from the last and then moving to the first, the example I gave of this game is a game that I think only works on the computer. It's a complex a strategy game that's a simulation of complex social dynamics. It would be very, very hard to implement that in a different medial form. So I think that's specific for computer games. Whether a computer game is necessary to teach the Occupy movement anything is a question I would like to raise, because I don't know if they need computer games. One name that hasn't been mentioned, one project is Jane McGonigal's whole concept of using, you know, game mechanics, and she's not only using digital game mechanics, but this whole idea of, you know, motivating people to achieve reachable goals, implement, you know, real-world political projects and make real changes in the world. I think that's a fascinating project. It does not need the digital medium, but it can profit from the digital medium, especially from, you know, the distribution network of the internet and the social networks, where you can get large numbers of people, you know, playing the same game. Because, you know, if one's really honest, you look at the way that society and culture is structured, it's structured by rules, you know. You can see that as a game with very real consequences. And I would say that there are games with real consequences, just like, you know, the games in ancient Rome, you know, were games played by the people in power that had very real consequences for the people in the arena. Just like the games of the Wall Street brokers have very real consequences for the rest of us. And that's getting to the first question you asked. Do we like this? I personally don't. Okay, I find it all highly disturbing. As a, you know, cultural scientist and futurologist, you know, I'm really how do you say it? I'm not, God, I'm I'm highly, highly disturbed at what I'm witnessing happening in the world. And there's a development that started in the middle of the 20th century where economists thought they could use game theory, someone brought this up earlier, to sort of model the world and quantify everything and put it into this perfect simulation that they would run on their beautiful computers and, you know, turn the world into this utopian place. What we have witnessed is the complete bankruptcy of that vision, and it's turned into a dystopic vision, and the system is basically, it has crashed. It needs to be rebooted. We need to conceive of completely new kinds of social games that bring people together with a vision of how the world can work, and I'm all for Occupy, and to maybe, you know, turn a phrase from the 20th century, the revolution will not only not be televised, I would say it won't be gamified either, right?
All right, so just because I'm seeing the big video game, which actually is a very interesting game by Molindustria, which actually is fun to play at least for some time, even if it's deadly serious. and it actually is a good example that shows how game can basically be conveying political message in some way, because here you basically play the McDonald's company and you have to raise cattle and soya beans and to produce burgers, sell them, and everything is quantifiable because you have to basically, the idea is to earn money in the end. But the funny thing is that in order to earn money, you have to play quite a dirty game. That is to say, you have to chop down the trees in the rainforest. You have to destroy the villages of the natives. You have to basically put dioxin in the food and everything, and cheat on politicians and bribe them and so on and so on. The thing is that within the rules of the game, there's this dynamic that you really have to do all this stuff. If you don't, you will lose very, very soon. So the interesting thing is that through the structure of these rules, the game basically teaches you that the whole industry, by its very structure, is totally corrupt. And it's not a question of your own moral decision, but by the structure of the industry. And this is some very interesting way how a game can basically make a political claim. And it even backs it up a little bit because they have some books they refer to and so on. So, right, everything which we tell you in the game is basically true, and this whole layer of representation is, on the one hand, quite familiar, on the other hand, totally ironic because you play in the role of the villain here. So, and it's only bearable because it says this cute little graphics.
I just think, and what we can learn from the computer games, because they're all reducing complexity to a very low degree, is that maybe we look at our economy and we see, okay, game theory or play theory in economics was too reduced, and now we see that so many other aspects have not been counted for, and now it all breaks down. So that is what I can learn. But I say we can learn from computer games.
So in case anyone has a question, you are please welcome.
I haven't seen the whole presentation. I've been cooking some rice in the kitchen, vegan. But I wonder, like, one, can you put somewhere the link to the source code later? Because I also like do little programming, so would probably like to look how you guys coded it, or if you know who did it. Okay. All right, but if you know how to get a source. And two, what do you think about connecting with like linked data and semantic web technologies that people can kind of visualize if they would like to have some like more vegetables to this rice and stuff, how we can organize ourselves without using this kind of approach with money, just seasons and nature and composting and cycles of nature, and actually use some linked data information to coordinate ourselves with this like game-like approach. Would like to maybe work, collaborate on developing it. We have a hack lab here, so if someone's interested, we can talk about different implementation. Does any of you like develop this kind of stuff, programs?
You should check out the Maze Festival. They do stuff you could like. It's an indie games festival hosted in Berlin every once a year. And they do a lot of these coding, open source, hackathons, game jams, whatever. It is called A-Maze, and it just happened last week, so you just missed it. It will be next year, but there's the Games Culture Circle, for example, where a lot of coders come together. There's the Global Game Jam once a year. There's there will be a festival of those guys in Johannesburg in September, where you use game mechanics for social change in Africa and stuff like that. So check it out. It's quite good.
In general, if you type into your browser, Games for Change is a good platform where people who are interested in using their coding skills to make that kind of game, you could contact them. So it's no one up here sitting up here could code, but otherwise, I'd be very interested in collaborating.
I missed the beginning of the discussion. I just wanted to ask, did you mention that there is this game, an ego shooter, about Occupy? If you Google Computerspiel, I think it's Rainbow Six, and it came, I just saw a short clip about it. It was in December of 2011, so quite fast after. If you Google it, and Occupy people are pictured there as terrorists. So I think that's like a 1 or 2 minute clip where they talk about it in Spiegel.de. I don't know. Occupy is like, I mean, the bad guys in this game are actually Occupy terrorists. Like they're, yeah. And it came out in December. Nobody ever talked about it, but I don't know.
So without knowing it, to me it looks like a so-called modification, which is a quite common kind of altering commercial games. Usually, especially this kind of ego shooters, first-person shooters are sold with an editor, which enables the player to create own worlds, gaming worlds, and also some people are more skilled with some hacking skills. They are able to create not only an own world but also own gaming rules, and this looks like a modification to me. So it's not a game which was sold somehow, but it was a game which was sold and then modified by somebody.
Yeah, the thing about such kind of shooters is that you basically have this engine and and then you have a graphic layer in front of that. And it's not so complicated to change this. And it happened quite a lot, actually, in history of political games, that people just basically changed this graphic layer. For example, there's shortly after the Iraq War started, there was some guy, some totally patriotic American, who basically made this very, very simple game called Quest for Saddam. Basically, it's like Castle Wolfenstein or something, where basically you have to shoot through corridors and you shoot Iraqi soldiers, and in the end you shoot Saddam Hussein. And for him it was this kind of political expression. He probably had the need to to make this game. And things that somehow in Iraq they realized that that game existed. And at that time, still Saddam Hussein was in charge. And some guy in Iraq took the very same game and just changed the graphic layer. So, and then you have exactly the same game with the one difference that you now shoot American soldiers, and then in the end you shoot George W. Bush. And so it is basically the same game, just the graphic layer changes. And this is very characteristic for this kind of 3D ego shooters, that this is possible. It's even like there's this one game called America's Army, probably some of you heard about it, which is actually a recruiting game by the real U.S. Army, which is, you can download it for free, you can play it. It's like a multiplayer shooter, like Counter-Strike a little bit. And if you play it, you always see yourself as an American soldier and your opponents as someone like Arabs, like communists, whatever. But the thing is that the other players who play against you also see themselves as American soldiers and you as communists or Arab or whatever. So these graphic layers are interchangeable.
You need to rent your house, because if you are out of your house, you are not able to play that game. You need to go to work so you get money to be able to play. I cannot see a life for free playing games at home. because you require your home, you require the electricity, you require to live on the capitalist world to play this kind of games. So how you live? Being a slave.
Yeah, thank you for that point. I actually would like to add on that. I mean, the whole issue of electricity is a political dimension of this whole media that we haven't talked about. But I mean, the consoles, they use more power than like three big refrigerators. And in a day and age where we're talking about peak oil and, you know, just, you know, a global warming, and we really have to change the way we live completely, and that's also what Occupy means for me, is really questioning the whole system. You have to question, you know, whether we're even going to be able to play these kinds of games in the future. I agree with you. I would like to leave that stand. No?
I wanted to go to what I think is maybe one of the most obvious but also the most tedious questions, talking about video games in this context, which didn't really come up very much, which is the ability of video games, especially first-person shooters, to inspire violent behavior in people who play them. You know, blaming video games for school shootings, et cetera, et cetera. I'm going to take a stab and imagine that most of you on the panel reject this interpretation, as I think a lot of people do. I'll let you respond to that after my comment. So assuming that many people reject this kind of easy causal relationship where violent video games cause violent behavior, I'm interested then in why it is that we can then look at things like gamification happening on Wall Street, for example, or gamification in the military context and the rise of drone warfare and new ways in which game technology is sort of seeping into military and real-world warfare and so on. And in this context, it seems much easier to look at video games and game technology as changing the way that we empathize or don't empathize with victims of Wall Street or victims of drone warfare and so on. So I'm wondering, why is it that it is kind of accepted that we reject an easy causal relationship between something like first-person shooter games and school shootings, but on the other hand, there seems to be a much more interesting, complex relationship between something like gamification and algorithms and people managing abstractions on Wall Street and abstractions in drone warfare, etc.?
I mean, the question is quite an old one, because there was much debate about cinema, also the violence in cinema and the violence in schools. And it's in some ways the same, because you cannot restrict. It's impossible to restrict, actually, violence in games, because bringing it down to such a cause and effect, it's just simplification of the problem. The problem has to be analyzed, addressed, and discussed. And the games have to be discussed. They should not be restricted. They should be shown there are limitations to the age, of course. But just restricting the games and not showing them and just campaigning against the games would not help, I think. What would help is the debate about the violence in games and the theoretical discourse and the discourse at schools and with the relevant age groups. And if you have more to add on that.
I just wanted to say, you gave the answer yourself. You said it's neglected, the simple cause and effect. But on the other hand, you have a complex gamification, indirect influencing theory of positive results. So obviously you reject a simple cause and effect rule, because it's not what people do, cause and effects. But the complex, the other way around, I totally agree on your basic argument. If you say serious games do have positive effects, you also have to say that violent fun games have negative effects, or can have. But I don't remember, one of you two also commented on that before, is it depends on how you use it. You can, of course, use a good first-person shooter to rebuild your school and train for your stuff and know how the range of weapons, because all the data is in there and stuff like that. But there's no simple cause and effect of violent content in general. Is it film, music, games, literature, and violent behavior? That's far too easy for far too many reasons to open up here.
But I don't think it was meant as simplistic as that, because I think you, you're going on towards, like, I think you can't isolate the computer game thing from other media, and I think you have to include, since the golfer, the whole presentation of news which are produced in the media, on television and so on, to somehow give a clean image of war, and that the aesthetic of computer games moved into the aesthetic of news. And so I think it's more a question of how the aesthetics merge together. So, and somehow you now have a new way of presenting reality, and which is not as longer, you can't separate that from the image or the aesthetics you have in computer games. I think it's more like a question, how do images of reality and how do images of what happens on the world, how are they changed in a media convergent environment? How do images of reality merge with images of fictions? And it's not a question of, do computer games have a direct effect or not?
But what I found interesting about your question is basically why we assume that this, with the broker in Wall Street, basically the use of this kind of models which are game-like, and he interacts in a playful way, while we say, right, this has an effect, and playing games has not. And so first, I wouldn't say that playing video games doesn't have an effect. I think it has an effect, but it's a little bit more complicated than this cause and effect model. On the other hand, I think there's one very, very crucial difference between this broker, for example, and the player. Because, if you play a game, by definition, you have to know that what you play is not real, because if you would think it's real, then you wouldn't play anymore. It would be something else. And the broker, on the other hand, he thinks that the models he's working with are real, or at least are representing reality in such a way that they are adequate. And what you just discovered, that they are not. So this is basically what the whole crisis is about. But the whole starting point is to think, right, this is the adequate way to represent reality, or even more to say that this is reality. And if you just look at economic discourse, for example, it's quite fascinating that they really very often talk about reality, but what they are actually talking about are their models. And I think you will not find a player who is not mad, which is possible. Of course, they are mad players. But the normal player will not think that the game in itself is reality. And I think this is the difference, basically.
That was actually perfect. No, I was going to say, sure.
About the electricity, you told me that a computer uses the energy of three frigorifics. Yeah, spend a lot of energy, and you play ecological games with electricity that comes from a nuclear plant 100 kilometers from here. So how ecological it is, the game, if it's destroying the planet?
Well, no. Well, I wouldn't. I mean, you basically summed it up. The problem I wanted to raise with that issue. I mean, that is the paradox of people making serious games, to try and have people be more energy conscious, and then they're using all this energy to play them. I mean, you know, they're usually played on a PC, and it doesn't use as much as a console, but it all takes energy to run. And just like the whole system that you drew up, you need the house, and you need the money, and so on. I think that is the most political dimension of these games, and not the content, and not the question of, you know, whether they raise violence or not, because there is no empirical data to really prove that. But this sort of, and the film The Matrix gives a very powerful image of what it's like to live in, you know, late capitalist society, and we're really hooked up to this simulation, and we keep it running with our own energy and with our own desire because we're having a good time doing it. And I don't know, it would be a nice note to stun. Maybe it's time to turn it off. Who knows? Yeah.
So, thank you very much. I think it was really, it came out that you have a lot of different views on politics, society, computer games. I think for us all, there are much more fields than we even thought about before. It was really very interesting discussion. I thank you for coming and the panelists, and thank you at the audience for listening all the time, and yeah, see you next time.
So, we can go on and on, and there are lots of other questions to discuss that can never end. The Computerspiele Museum Berlin organizes panels, and we could go on with that in cooperation with the museum for the panels, and you are all invited, and we thank you for an interesting discussion. It was wonderful.